Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello, everybody, and good afternoon on this wonderful sunny day here in Chicago. In this podcast, we have the honor and privilege of talking with Mr. Chris Ellis. He is a cybersecurity facilitator and an instructor at a leading training organization called Circadence. They're based in Boulder, Colorado. Chris, thanks for your time. Let's go ahead and get started. And I have the honor because you're the first, I guess, true cyber educator I've really interviewed on this podcast series. So thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome. Glad to be here.
Yeah. Well, we looked up your bio, did some background snooping on you on Google and LinkedIn. Can you tell us some of the highlights of your career, kind of like how you got started into IT security or cyber and how you ended up where you're at, where you are at today?
Yeah, sure. How much time do you have? But, yeah, I go back quite a while. I was a network and security go ahead.
You can go as long as you want, Chris. You're the guest, so.
Yeah, okay. No problem. I'm just teasing. I'm just been in the industry for a while. So, yeah, I was a networking and security consultant for a good 10 years, you know, starting back in the mid-90s. And during that time, I wasn't doing just what I would call traditional consulting work. You know, working at client sites and helping them with their projects. But I was also hired to deliver speaking engagements around the world, live seminars. That was a lot of fun, you know, but I was on stage, different countries, different cities, different countries, showcasing. At that time, it was network data test tools. That was a big thing. It was a lot of fun. And then come around 2006, I joined McAfee, which a lot of people will probably know it as McAfee, but it was actually McAfee. Uh-huh. McAfee. Yeah, I spent 15 years there, and I was working as a system engineer. And if you know what a system engineer is, they are basically the technical half of the sales team, right? That's the, you know, there's the team that goes out, the guy with the nice watch, and then there's the guy who's the who delivers all the presentations, and that was me. But then after that, I joined Circadence, where I now lead the instructional services team and deliver cybersecurity workshops. Yeah, thanks.
Oh, excellent, excellent. Now, one question I want to ask you here, you know, and here in the U.S., especially in, you know, cybersecurity, everybody talks about, and we'll get to this later in the podcast, about training and need for security awareness training. But there are a lot of obstacles into delivering an effective program, you know, for employees, because a lot depends upon what their job title is, you know, what the needs are. And you don't want to keep their learning or lectures or whatever, you know, more, you don't want to keep them for more than 20, 30 minutes. So how have you overcome some of these obstacles, or is this something you'd like to talk about a little later on in the podcast?
No, I can talk about that. You're right. It is a challenge, keeping people's interest piqued, you know, because I used to do, like I said, I was actually doing stand in the room, in person, technical delivery, 3-day workshops. And it is a challenge. I had people put their heads down on the desk and go to sleep. I never took offense to it because I just knew, you know, yeah, well, you're going through a lot of really technical, boring stuff. And to be fair, it takes an exceptional student that can stay really on point and listening. But, so we're a gamified platform. Circadence has this platform called Project Ares. It's a gamified platform, and there's a good statistic out there. I'm just going to wing this. It's 60% of those. 60% retention. If you gamify a platform, then the retention levels are 60% higher than if you just to stand and deliver. So we take advantage of that for sure, Ravi. Yeah, we have the ability to make it interesting and fun. And after our workshops, everybody kind of comes away with, well, that was really cool. I didn't expect it to be, you know, that much fun spending, because we spend a good 3 to 5 hours in these workshops, and yet we keep it interesting. So that is the challenge, and I think we do a pretty good job of it.
Oh, excellent. Now, how long has Circadence been in business? It sounds like it's been around for quite a long time.
Yeah, funny enough, I said my career in consulting started mid-90s. That's about when Circadence was founded as well, around 1995. I'd say they've been innovating and growing their footprint, quite a while. And gamified, and honestly, I hadn't heard of them either, because they were kind of targeting a very specific area that I wasn't involved in the time. But they deliver, they've had the cybersecurity content delivering it for that long. We've grown to service enterprise organizations, government entities. You can imagine academic institutions use our platform to complement their syllabus. What else can I say? We have a lot of interesting content as well. So, you know, the basics, ransomware, neutralization for sure. We also have networking topics, cybersecurity fundamentals, SCADA, ICS, industrial control systems. Yeah, so all of this stuff, Ravi, is based on real-world attacks so that students are given that opportunity to work through, you know, real-world issues and learn how to fix, remediate. And, yeah, and it's all through a hands-on platform. It's pretty cool.
Well, and are these lab-based environments, I'm assuming you're probably basing them in the cloud. Are they? Can they be on-prem, or are they in the cloud as a SaaS offering for students? And
yeah.
So what kind of platform? Use AWS or Azure or both, perhaps?
Oh, yeah, it's a good question. A lot of our content is on Azure because of we have a relationship with Microsoft. But we are very cloud forward. I like that term. Not bound by the traditional, you know, brick and mortar kind of thing. But yeah, we still do on site though. We've actually done on site events, but we still plug into our cloud and deliver it through almost like, you know, overhead projectors, so people get the same experience. Now that's for me as an instructor / facilitator, they can see what I'm doing, but everybody has their own machine. They log into their own account, so they're all doing it right in front of themselves on their own laptops.
Wow, okay, excellent. Now, do you have a presence in other countries as well, too?
So we are based in, we have a couple of folks. Well, at least we're fairly global. There's somebody in Poland. Most of the company is based out of Colorado, and I'm the odd man out that's up here in Canada. There's actually a couple of us up here. So truly a globally distributed kind of organization. But as far as our audience goes, yeah, no, we have workshops all over the world. We do them in Australia, and that means that we're on the mic at typically, 8 o'clock at night, because it's like noon in Australia. So we do them in Japan. You know, we do them in Asia, APAC, South America, North America, Europe, all over the world, pretty much, yeah.
Okay, excellent. Now, who is your typical customer base like? I mean, it seems like it could be anybody, really. I mean, small and medium-sized businesses, Fortune 500, government entities. Who's your cream of the crop in this regard?
Yeah, great question. I would say all of the above, sort of. We definitely work with Fortune 500 companies. I mentioned Microsoft. We also have small to medium businesses, a lot of educational institutions. So there's a couple of multifaceted aspects. Some companies use our platform, to integrate their security tools into, so that people can use our platform to get potential customers hands-on with their tools, right? So that's a sales kind of swing. We also, however, have pre-built content that educational institutions can use to complement, like I mentioned earlier, to complement perhaps they already have a cyber course, and they're also trying to make it interesting, right? Because everybody's trying to struggle with just basic, kind of boring, you know, cybersecurity content. So when you add a gamified portion to it, where the people get in and use a lab, and it's in a gamified environment, that's cool, right? So a lot of educational institutions come to us so that they can complement their existing curriculum with what we do. Yeah. So it's a lot of different people we deal with.
Yeah, let's get into your product and service line. Actually, your website right now, and you said that Project Aries was like your main product, you know, offering. Can you do a deeper dive into that and talk about the various components that you use in that to educate your audience?
Yeah, for sure. So within Project Aries, we have we spin up what we call virtual cyber ranges. They're virtual machines that are pre-built with all of this exciting content. It's used for practice and honing. People use it to hone, you know, so it's people new to the industry can use these to learn straight up. Others who are already in the industry can come in and hone their cybersecurity skills, and we have different levels of content, starting with our, you know, we have these six kind of fun learning games. One of them is kind of like Trivial Pursuit. You know, there's all these different games that people play, and they challenge everything from conversion between binary and hexadecimal and cyber topics. And then once they finish with that, they move on to the battle rooms. And these are specific scenarios that are designed to train on very fundamental tasks related to a specific technical topic. The battle room labs, they're very foundational in that all cybersecurity professionals should be proficient in these topics. And they are pretty wide-ranging topics, everything from, you know, Linux fundamentals to Windows fundamentals to network analysis using Wireshark. So there's quite a variety. And those are, again, very focused on a single topic or two. And then moving on to missions, because we also have this concept of missions. But they're a little bit more advanced. They're based upon actual breach events that have occurred in the wild. And they're either played offensively, what we call a red team, You've probably heard of red team, blue team exercises.
Okay.
So that's where one team is attacking the other and the other's defending. It's kind of fun. So we have those. Again, there's still a virtual environment, and they're a lot more complex than a battle room scenario. And they require the learner to actually combine what I would say is like multiple skill sets to complete the learning objectives. And again, they complete, oh yeah, these can be played individually or they can be played as teams. We've had organizations hire them to do the red team, blue team kind of thing. Love it. Everybody comes away a winner on those. But yeah, they're very fun. Yeah.
Excellent. Now, which battle room is your favorite and why is it your favorite?
That's a great question. Yeah, there's so many of them. It's like trying to pick one of your kids as being your favorite, right? I would tend to go with Battle Room 9. It's the forensics lab, and that's just something I kind of dig. It gives people access to, yeah, we call them learners or players. It depends on what kind of spin, because they are in a gamified platform, so we tend to call them either players or learners, but they have access to this tool called Autopsy. It's a digital forensic tool, and it's quite amazing. It's quite complex. And when you get into it, the more you play with it, the more you really you can learn, and it's a lot of fun. Yeah, so it teaches a lot of the nuances of a real forensic investigation, and again, it keeps it fun. It has this entertaining kind of nerd-friendly superhero kind of spin. Captain America, Steve Rogers, is part of the actual conversation in that. It's kind of fun. Anyhow, learners get to crack a case of an employee espionage, which is, again, not only timely, because this happens in the real world, but it's a lot of fun.
Excellent. Now, when you educate your audience, is it mostly on how to take the opposite role? Is it just for cybersecurity threats, or do you offer training like for other areas in cyber, like doing certifications, or someone just wants to learn something more about a topic in more detail? Or do you just specifically focus on like security awareness training? That's what I have to say.
Yeah, so again, a lot of it is either cyber specific, espionage attacks, ransomware attacks, what I would call kind of your real central to cyber, but then a lot of it is fringe as well. I mentioned Wireshark. That's technically a tool that just does network analysis, right? You can just track, or like a DVD, you can kind of record, I'm going to date myself, like a video recorder. You can actually record network traffic. But that's what Wireshark is. You can capture traffic and then do post analysis on it. I've used that for many, many years, nothing to do with security specifically, just sometimes if you're trying to troubleshoot a network problem, right? But it definitely has played well into the security space. So, yeah, what I would call some of them are fringe topics. Linux, again, you know, I mentioned that earlier, it's not a cybersecurity core technology per se, but it definitely is something you want to know. So, yeah, a lot of the topics are just centered around important concepts that anybody who's in the industry should know about. And then there are the hardcore, if you will, cybersecurity topics that we deal as well.
Okay, excellent. Now, what is the topic of concern that were at the most interest listeners in the audience?
Sorry, Ravi, say that again?
Yeah, which topic seems to be the most, it seems to garner the most interest or most concern with your audience? Like, what do they want to be educated on the most? Or what do you see as the most in-demand topic for cybersecurity?
Yeah, okay, got it. Sorry, that's a good question. There is a lot to choose from in that respect, for sure. One area that I see some interest in, too, is what we call OWASP. That's the open, you have to love the acronyms, right? Open Worldwide Application Security Project. That's been around since the early 2000s. And what I like about this organization is, and I like any organization that gets its arms around this industry, because companies have a tendency to want to go proprietary, right? And that's always, it's fine for many things, but it's not great in cybersecurity, because if we are collectively trying to attack or prevent the attacks hitting us, then it really helps to have standards that we're using regardless of who or which vendor we're dealing with, right? So, yeah, there's a couple of organizations out there. OWASP is one. They tend to focus a lot on, again, I mentioned they were since 2000, so I've known these guys. I got heavily involved with them around 2005, just before I joined McAfee, actually. They have chapters all around the world. I connected up with the Canadian chapter. But one of their biggest initiatives is the OWASP Top 10, something I've always been plugged into. And more recently, it's a companion initiative called the OWASP API Security Top 10. And these are kind of important because not only are they letting you be aware of application security issues that are evolving in the world real time. But the API part is kind of new. APIs are very important, right? That's how applications communicate with each other. And if they're not secure, then somebody can jump on that API highway, so to speak, and essentially take over your network. Kind of scary stuff.
Exactly, exactly. Now, talking about that topic, and you know, we were talking about supply chain issues, that, you know, why do you think these are some of the biggest mistakes that are being made today, and why is it such an important topic? I mean, I can give my two cents in here, too, but I'd like to know what you think first.
Yeah, on supply chain issues specifically? Sorry, Ravi.
Or just security configuration mistakes, you know, software configuration, software security issues.
Yeah. Sorry. It's all about, right? If you, I think a lot of the issues that happen are because of, you know, human misconfiguration. That's a big thing. And that's why I mentioned the OWASP for sure. It really helps you to understand your own industry and things that you should be looking for. Best practices, for example, right? But when you are configuring your organization's security systems, you know, it's important to keep a balance. And I used to sort of advocate this all the time when I was at McAfee. You have to find that happy balance between what's necessary from a security point of view versus maintaining ease of use, right? So anything that's more than strictly necessary, you know, can potentially introduce security gaps. So that, putting it in one way, if somebody isn't doing their homework right, then they're going to have security. It's things like default passwords, like that kind of thing, those kind of configuration issues, right? But when talking about a system's usability, right, it's important to think and remember that security and usability can be inversely proportional, like I was trying to say. And if you don't do it right, and if the security is too draconian, and there's a lot of friction for people using their basic apps, then they're going to try and find workarounds. The classic example I can think is if you're trying to do data loss prevention and you've implemented some sort of USB protection so people can't copy stuff to the USBs. Well, they really want to do it, so now they try to send it to their personal cloud account, right? Dropbox or Box. So now there's tools we have to have that. It's called CASB, right? Cloud Access Security Brokers. You have to protect stuff going into the cloud. So, you know, and I think the challenge is to do that right. Because if you do it elegantly, if you do it correctly, the users won't perceive the friction. It's not too difficult for them to use. And everybody comes away happy. So the users are happy. They're not trying to work around the controls. And yet there's enough security controls that are in place to make sure that the environment's safe. So I find that yin and yang, sort of the biggest challenge out there, is finding that right balance between security controls, security configurations that work, that don't make it so difficult that the users just avoid it or try to get around it.
Okay, excellent. Now, you talk about default settings. Why are they so dangerous? I mean, in the blogs that I've written, I always, you know, right, you know, never use a default settings, especially when it comes to IoT devices. You know, always make it, you know, compatible to what your own security needs are. Can you elaborate more why the defaults are so insecure?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of those things. It's to get things working out of the box, there often are defaults. You know, I can think of even the most common thing, a little basic router. Maybe the user account is called admin and the password is admin. And I've found people that just don't change those things, right? And it's like, okay, job one, you want to probably change the default password. Now, that's on a very simplified scale, but that's a real-life example. I was working at an organization when I was a consultant, and somebody illegally installed some Wi-Fi content, and we found it and locked it down because they hadn't changed the default password. But, you know, you take that on a much larger scale, and it's the same sort of thing. Sometimes the default passwords are just too – or it's one of those check boxes, yeah, I'll get around to that. People are working. You know, the whole industry right now is, I think, challenged too with finding really good cybersecurity professionals. That's one of the pitches I use for our organization. People come here to learn because it's so topical right now. There's so much demand for cybersecurity professionals, and I think there's a shortage out there. So either the time crunch is there, people don't have the time to properly configure things. There's not enough personnel that understand the issues. Management doesn't understand the issue, so they don't force, guidelines on how to get things done like that. It happens. Things are just, you know, and that's the first thing the attacker's going to do. And we don't forget, attackers, they can throw 1,000 different things at you. You have to defend all 1,000. They only have to get one that works, and they're in. So, sure, part of their toolkit is going for the basics, right? Do they use default passwords? And surprisingly enough, it works. So that's a biggie for sure.
Well, okay. Now, can you talk about what unnecessary features are? Can you go into a little bit more detail onto that, please?
Yeah, for sure. Well, unnecessary features, let me think off the top of my head. So let's say your SecOps, which is your security operations team, right? You know, I was talking about draconian security and how much is too much. Sometimes I kind of work in the closet. And again, drawing from my own experience as a consultant, I saw this firsthand. I was working for the network security team, and we would find issues, vulnerabilities. We would do vulnerability scans, and we would basically take what we found and throw it over this wall to the team that's supposed to fix it, and we never really found out if they did or not. So you sometimes see that disconnect. So I always find it, you know, that shows you the maturity level of an organization. In a perfect world, though, the SecOps team would work really closely with the various application delivery teams. What a concept, right? The teamwork is the dream work. But, you know, if you can get to that maturity level where you're actually working together so the application delivery people don't dictate, because you always find that kind of dictatorial approach. Application delivery says to the network team, we're implementing this, you know, it's just make it happen. And then the security team goes, oh, well, we need to look at it. And they're going, well, don't stop our application from working. You know, we've spent a lot of time on this. So if there isn't that nice cooperative kind of handshake, then it's going to be a big, big challenge. But when you do get it, I think that's where you get the magic happens. So then you can negotiate what features are really necessary on this application. If they're not necessarily going to be used, let's remove them so that there isn't that extra app that somebody can get in and attack. And, you know, reducing your attack surface, basically. And then shared services that aren't really need. Or here's another great one, active network ports that should be locked down, which could be open, like they're like little doors and windows that are open for attackers. If you can have that intelligent discussion, you can say, yeah, I get this application, but here's all the ports I see that are open. Are all of them really needed? Well, yes, some of them are needed for remote access, but how, you know, let's use some RBAC perhaps, you know, role-based access controls. Who really needs access to all these different ports and what have you. But, yeah, so that's a complex topic for sure. But I'd say in summary, then the more mature the organization, the more likely you're going to find really good cooperation between the security team and the application delivery teams.
Excellent. Now, can you do a little bit of a deeper dive into insecure permissions and least privilege, like what your thoughts on that are, please?
Yeah, for sure. I did touch on it. You know, so when an organization authorizes its users for access to tools or access to data, a best practice I find is to use the least privilege approach, you know. And there is, not surprisingly, an acronym for this. It's the POLP. POLP stands for the Principle of Least Privilege. And it basically refers to an information security concept that says give the user minimum levels of access or permissions needed to perform their job functions. That's almost exactly copied right out of a Google search. That's the technical part of it. And it's a proven tactic, you know. So moving on to that concept then, if you don't mind, it's a proven tactic to ensure that users have appropriate authorization and to prevent creating too much work for the system admins. Because that's the other problem, is if the system admins get overloaded with all these individual requests, like I talked about trying to reduce who can access what. And if you're in a large organization with thousands of users, you could have a team of 50 people trying to keep up with the change requests, right? And who gets access? Bob gets access to this. Sue gets access to this. So what will you do with an RBAC, which is roles-based access control, says that, hey, we're going to set up these controls based on a role. We'll have a finite number that we can manage, and then you slot people into those roles. So if somebody new to the organization comes in, the management team says, oh, they fit into this group, desktop user, whatever they might call them, then you can just apply that global policy to them, and bam, right off the bat, they don't have over access, they don't have too little access, they have exactly the access they need to get their job done. So that's a really great approach that a lot of organizations use today for sure.
Excellent. Now, do you teach your audience, your clients, about what's known as privileged access management? It's, you know, using the same principles here, but using it for those super user accounts, you know, like for, like project managers, network administrators, CISOs, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, controls like that are always a bit of a challenge because if I think I read your question correctly, there's always going to be kind of exceptions to the rule. And even though I talk so elegantly about the RBAC, everybody, you know, nicely fits into a profile, sometimes you don't. You mentioned senior management. Sometimes CEOs just want things that, you know, the average person in the organization might think is outrageous, but we don't understand what kind of, you know, sales slash business activities they're up to. So they can often try to supersede some of the security controls, and then that, in my mind, it just kind of creates a bit of an issue. A, yes, you have to do what they want. Often it's their company. But B, it can introduce, and also it's an image thing. It's like when you start breaking the controls that are in place for just a couple of high-privileged individuals, it sends almost the wrong message, but it also can open up and introduce some security holes for sure.
Excellent. Now, and as we approach the last part of the show here, I just want to get your thoughts on a couple of cyber issues here. First one is, now, it doesn't have to relate to circadians or project areas or anything like that, just like your own general thoughts. The Internet of Things, I find this to be very scary. You know, I don't like having the thoughts of everything connected. I still have, for that matter, I don't have a smart car or a smart home. I still drive an old-fashioned analog, you know, instrumentation, a Honda Civic 03. What are your thoughts on the IoT? Do you have a smart home or a smart car or anything like that? Or?
You know, the thing is I think IoT was born from convenience and kind of just cool. Yeah, I agree. I don't have a lot of IoT either. I'll be honest with you. I just turn my lights on and off but without my app. But the IoT devices just don't have a lot of security built into them. That's their inherent. Because they're cheap and they're small and they do small little functionalized things, people think, it's just turning my lights on. How dangerous can it be, right? But then you get that, you know, grow that out to industrial control systems even, or OT. I think a sister technology to IoT, which is the Internet of Things, is OT, which is operational technologies. And, you know, people love OT. You know, these are the apps that say, hey, your Uber is 5 minutes away, and it shows you on a map where it is. OT is also what lets you get those little pings from Amazon that say, your package is going to be delivered in the next 2 hours. So, you know, those technologies are cool. They're great. They're useful. People love them. But whether IoT or OT, the security background of it or the aspect of it isn't always covered off well. I think operational technologies, they're better at it because those are larger companies. But on the IoT side, these nice, cool little devices, that's what makes them cheap and small. They just don't have any inherent security. So it is a concern to me for sure that there's somebody looking at this, you know, that there's some. And a lot of the major vendors do have tools that can manage and monitor and look for IoT attacks. So that's the good thing.
Excellent. Now, before the show, we were talking a little bit about AI and ChatGPT. As we all know, I mean, it's the rage right now here, you know, globally, you know, that AI is going to take over the world. It's going to, you know, replace jobs and all that. I mean, I've written a book on AI, and I got another one coming out here, here pretty soon. But I don't think it's going to be all that. I just, you know, I mean, we'll never, you know, understand the human brain completely. In fact, my father was actually a professor at Purdue in West Lafayette, Indiana. He was in the spinal cord regeneration research and said, at most, we'll only understand maybe 0.05% of how the whole human brain works. So, you know, a lot of people, you know, they don't understand that compared with everything. What are your thoughts about AI, ChatGPT, if it takes the whole world or, you know, what have you?
Yeah, given your background, I think I should be asking you that question because it's such a great topic. Yeah, I have my own point of view for sure on it. I think it's fantastic. I use it. I don't use ChatGPT. I do have a little app, though, and I can ask it questions ChatGPT-ish like, and it just gives me brilliant answers. But I use it for learning because that's the kind of nerd I am. But then, you know, you look at you're right, the whole, everything from the Terminator on to this new show that's coming out this year. I'm looking forward to it. It's called The Creator, and it's all about how AI has dropped a nuclear weapon somewhere in North America. So that's the kind of scary stuff that people love to talk about. But, you know, from a practical point of view, I agree. I think it's a cool new technology. It's going to be very catchy. It's going to help a lot. And we're going to get smarter at how to control it and how to detect it, fake articles, fake news with it. I think that's something that we'll all have to deal with. I think 99%, like most of the world, I think 90%, 99% maybe is all going to be good, and it only takes 1% to try and do something stupid with it. And we'll deal with that, you know, as we do with everything that comes out. But I think it'll do more good than bad.
Yeah, I mean, I'm at the point, you know, and I just get so tired of hearing, oh, it's going to take over the world, it's going to replace jobs. It's not going to do anything like that. If anything, it's only going to augment and help. It's not going to replace anything, especially when it comes to automated processes like in penetration testing, threat hunting to help, you know, with those mundane tests, so the pen test can keep in mind of the big picture. And especially when it comes to, like, using it for STEM systems, you know, like for triaging warnings, alerts, and filtering for false positives. I think that's where it's really going to be used the best. Oh. But I don't think it's going to take over the world or anything.
Yeah, no, and thank you for bringing it back to the topic at hand. You're right. Some of the tools that I've been working with, some of the vendors, they're integrating AI. And it's brilliant because, you know what, SIM is a great example. I'm glad you brought that up, Rafi, because, you know, SIM is looking at trillions of log data entries, right? And as a human being, it's like trying to find a needle in a – not only a needle in a haystack, it's trying to, like, find 10,000 needles in 10,000 haystacks. We could never do it. AI, artificial intelligence, yeah, it's like, oh, I see these patterns that a human would never see. Brilliant. And it lets it bubble up to the top and says, I think I see an attack, you know? So I think from that perspective, even in our – go ahead, yeah. Oh, I was just going to say that even in our platform, we have this in-game advisory called Athena, which uses AI to answer intelligent, you know, people can type in a question. It answers that. I use a voiceover tool because I do video editing as well, and it's based on AI. So the realism of the voice that it produces is really remarkable. And I use it in a limited way. I still hire real voiceover actors because I'm sensitive to that whole cause as well. But for quick demos, I can create these clips and then hire people. And that's exactly what I'm doing now. I'm working on a Japanese translation, and I'm working with a Japanese translation artist. So, yeah, but I think, it is going to be pervasive. It's going to be helpful in many aspects of what we're doing, for sure, not just cybersecurity. It's cool.
Well, I think the reason why people are so scared of AI is because it has this black box thing. But really, all AI is garbage in, garbage out. Only as good as, data that you feed it. And you still need
I think you nailed it right there.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay, well,
right.
The next,
so true.
Yeah. The next topic is COVID. You know, back in 2019 when COVID was erupting in the Wuhan province in China, we all thought it would be contained there, but it basically turned the world upside down, inside up 50 times over. What are your thoughts on COVID and how did it impact your company, the remote workforce? Do you think the remote workforce now is going to be the way the work model is going to be, or it's going to be hybrid, or what are your thoughts on all that?
Yeah, that certainly had a huge impact. And it, funny enough, didn't impact me directly because I had been a home worker for some time. I mentioned I was at McAfee for 15 years, starting in 2006. Well, the first 10 years I was in the field, like I said, as a system engineer, but for the last five, which has taken me, roughly in the past 7 years or so, I was part of a global operations team, so I was at home working. So I got quite used to that ability to work and the convenience of it. But, yeah, watching everybody else fold into that model is an interesting challenge. And, I see even Zoom just had an announcement that they're going to ask their workforce to come back to the office, which I thought was a really cool irony that the company that helped enable so much remote work is now actually asking their employees. Now they're doing it. They're saying if it's within 50 miles and it's 2 days a week. So I think that's the intelligent way. People do like to see their people in the office because there is this better kind of just natural human collaboration that we get. Things you bump into somebody and you find out something that you wouldn't have known otherwise, and that's always been an intriguing and important part of our workforce. So I can understand why companies are trying to get us back there, but there's just there's just too much overwhelming desire, I'd say, by people to really want to work from home because they feel they're more productive. And you hear people say, well, how do we know they're being productive? Well, how do you know if they're being productive at the office? Somebody could still show up and be just as non-productive there as they are at home. So I think you have to deal with non-productive employees versus remote employees. I think the vast majority are doing it the right way, because I know when I'm working out of my house, I am super busy, and I'm sure you find the same. So it's not a productivity issue. I think it's more of a trust.
Okay, excellent. Now, thinking long-term, how do you think Project Aries and Circadence will help ease the cybersecurity workforce job shortage? How do you think it's going to be used to help bridge that gap, how to get more people into cybersecurity?
Yeah, good question. So I'd say that learning and understanding the concepts, principles, all that good stuff behind cybersecurity is, more important than ever. I mentioned that there is a skills shortage. That's a fact. Trying to find good cybersecurity professionals, it's just a challenge. Why? Because there's nobody out there trained. We're helping with that for sure. And even within the past few weeks, President Biden released the White House fact sheet, right? And it was announcing the cyber workforce and education strategy. The goal is to address the nation's immediate, I'm quoting here, immediate and long-term cyber workforce needs. When I saw that, I went, yeah, exactly. I've always said that. There's a shortage out there for sure. So there is a gap. A lack of cybersecurity professionals in the workforce. But to answer your question, I think Project Ares has been developed to deliver, you know, that all-important cyber training. But there's a couple of key words we'd like to use. One is immersive, and the other is gamified. And that does tie back to, yeah, there's training, people putting their heads down on their desk, literally falling asleep when I used to deliver the – yeah, they were. It was a three-day technology course for one of the local high-tech companies, for sure. So to avoid that, yeah, it's immersive, which – because they're like three-hour workshops, some of these. You know, some of the battle rooms, sure, they're 1 or 2 hours. But, you know, we're talking immersive enough that people really get something out of it versus it being fluffy. So that's the immersive part. But then the gamified part, like I said, it really helps with retention. So I think it's just a more fun way. And it helps encourage people to come in to learn, right? So that's our key, for sure. Gamified, immersive, those are the keywords we use. Go ahead.
Cool. Can you explain a little bit more what gamification is to our audience? Some people may not know what it really means, but can you kind of explain, give the bird's eye view of what it's really all about?
Yeah, for sure. It's the idea is that there's usually goals that people try to achieve, and they can win coins and spend coins to help with their superpowers, let's say. I've played games where your coins can be used to upgrade your weapons, you know, or to get access to a different portal. And we introduce those kind of concepts. So we actually have badges that people can earn. There's skill badges. There's and also a progress chart and a level. You're assigned like a level, like cadet initially. And as you move through and learn and finish, complete successfully different battle rooms or missions, then it increases your experience points, and that raises you up from cadet to expert to architect. So it gives you that kind of a path, and that's what most games have. They have a beginning and end. There's a pathway that people can take, and along the journey, they can earn skills and points and use those points to purchase other things. Now, in our game, the points are used to buy hints, and I love that because there's kind of like a dichotomy. When people show up at, let's say, one of our workshops, they may have a lot of cyber skills already, and there's a leaderboard, right? So everybody wants to get to the top of the leaderboard. And if you have good, strong cyber skills, you can probably pop right to the top of the leaderboard without using the hints. But then for those who are on more of the learning journey, and they're going, I don't know how to answer this. Well, we have a built-in hints. I mentioned Athena, an AI-based coach, if you will, that you can ask questions to. And the hints cost points, but those hints will help point you to the answer. So it's that nice little, you know, can I do it without the hints? If I'm stuck, I have that help there. So nobody gets left behind, and I think that's really super important. That way everybody progresses. Some get higher up the leaderboard than others. Some people could care less about the leaderboard because they're there to learn, and they're using their money to, you know, their coins to spend on hints, and they're fine with that. And then there's those who just like to be at the top of the leaderboard. There's always that kind of dichotomy when we run these workshops. Yeah, so that's what I would say is gamified, is that you have a journey, you have goals, you have the ability to rise up the leaderboard, and you have you're earning coins to spend on useful things.
Cool, excellent. Now, another side question here before we wrap up here is when you deliver a class, is there a certain format that you follow? Is it kind of like a one-size-fits-all, or you kind of just customize it to the needs of who you're reaching out to? Like, for example, maybe the first 15 minutes will be all like a lecture, and then the last 20 minutes will be a lab, something like that? Or what's your approach like?
Yeah, they're all a little different. Battle rooms, I mentioned they're kind of simplified in that they focus on a specific topic, like Linux fundamentals. So that has an element, and those are usually tied, though, into an existing curriculum. So remember I said we deal a lot with universities who say, hey, we have a cybersecurity and course, and perhaps Linux is part of that, and they will tie into ours. So people will come to us not so much to learn the Linux, although it teaches them as well, but also to test their knowledge and to encourage and fine-tune and hone their skills. So there's that. They're a little bit simpler. There's the missions that are a bit more grandiose, a bit bigger, more hours to play. And then we have these other workshops that we, remember I said it's used as a sales tool, where vendors will come to us and we wrap their security tools into our gamified platform, and then they invite potential customers, prospects in to play. And that's very heavily guided. meaning the facilitators are involved. Yes, there's a one-hour presentation at the presentation at the beginning that talks to the technology. So there's a little bit of variations between the things that we do, those things being, again, battle rooms, missions, and workshops.
Yeah, excellent. Well, Chris, what's the best way for someone to get a hold of you in case you're interested in learning more about Project Aries or Cadence, or if they just want your services for training? What's the best way for someone to contact you?
Yeah, good question. We have an email that's basically sales@circadence.com. And that'll drop into a mailbox that somebody will respond back to them for sure. Yeah, that's probably the best. I think there's also on our website, which of course is circadence.com, there's a form that people can complete and ask for more information as well.
Okay. Excellent, Chris. We thank you for your time this afternoon. And you really shed a lot of, you know, important stuff on, you know, cyber training and, you know, what, you know, on the cyber, you know, workforce shortage. Thanks for your time, and we look forward to having you again in the future.
Yeah, me too. I had a good time. This is fun. I hope to do it again with you soon. Thank you.
Thanks. Take care. Have a good afternoon.
Yeah, cheers.